Made possible with support from World Harvest Foods, celebrating 16 years of serving the community and 6 years at their current location from Friday, April 7th through Monday, April 10th. World Harvest at the intersection of 6th and University, Champaign.
This is Focus 580, the second hour of our program. I'm David Inge, the host. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the issue of asylum and refugee women. Around the world, there are women who suffer persecution simply because they are women. They're women who have been victims of domestic violence. They've been raped, forcibly sterilized, ritually mutilated, sold into sexual slavery. And some of them, in an effort to escape these conditions, have tried to come to the United States to seek asylum. But this is complicated because the law that applies to asylum is not, it's not totally clear on women who have been victims of sexual discrimination. That is, discrimination simply because they are women. This is the subject of a conference that will be taking place here on the campus a little bit later on this week, as a matter of fact, on Wednesday, titled Seeking Asylum, Refugee Women, Family Violence, and Law. This is an event that is jointly sponsored by the Women and Gender and Global Perspectives Program. That's a unit of International Programs and Studies, and also the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with two guests who will be here to take part in this conference, Karen Musalo and Joanne Lynn. And let me just tell you a little bit about the two of them. Karen Musalo is a resident scholar at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, where she directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She also teaches refugee law and international human rights. She served as an expert consultant to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and also the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. She's testified before members of Congress on refugee issues and as an immigration and refugee law expert. She has also litigated a number of significant asylum decisions. Also joining us this morning is Joanne Lynn. She is a senior staff attorney at Legal Momentum. She is a national expert on immigration legal options for abused immigrants. Before joining Legal Momentum, she practiced immigration law in San Francisco for 5 years. They are both joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. And in fact, if you're listening on the internet, you may also use the toll-free line, as long as you're in the United States. And that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL or 9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. And we do also have a toll-free line. Again, use that if it would be a long-distance call for you. That's 800-222-9455. Well, Karen Musalo, hello.
Hello.
And Joanne Lynn, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you both very much for giving some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Just to start out in talking in basic terms, maybe it would be useful to start out just talking in basic terms about the law of asylum and what it says about who can seek asylum here in the United States and what kind of conditions have to apply for that person to qualify.
Well, maybe I can start with the definition of a refugee is a person who has something that we call a well-founded fear of persecution on account of, or it has to be connected to, five different grounds that are race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. It's a definition that came into existence after World War II, sort of the failure of the international community to respond to individuals fleeing the Holocaust. And what comes up in the women's claims, if you just think about that definition, it requires a kind of harm that would be considered to be persecution. And that harm has to be linked to, as I said, one of these five grounds, race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And generally, the persecution is thought to come from the government. So what comes up in the women's cases, just to cut to the chase with what the issues are, is that often what happens to women isn't considered to be persecution because it might be something required by culture or religion, and people don't see it as being persecution, even if it's a very grievous and damaging type of harm. And also, because it has to be on account of one of those five grounds I mentioned, and gender isn't one of the grounds, that's gotten in the way and has been seen as an obstacle. What I can talk about either now or a little bit later is how the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and many other countries that have considered the issue have found ways to work within that definition to include women. The U.S. is still struggling with the issue, but that's a little bit in a nutshell, the legal definition and what are some of the issues that come up in women's claims.
I assume this is just Karen that I've been listening to.
Yes.
I'll try to see if I can get your two voices straight here. Then, Joanne Lind, is there anything you would like to add to that?
Not really. Karen Misalu truly is the national expert on women and gender refugee claims, but I did want to note that there are other forms of immigration relief for many immigrant victims of domestic abuse, sexual assault, dating violence. And Legal Momentum played a leading role in getting the Violence Against Women Act Reauthorization Act passed recently, which was signed into law by President Bush in January of this year. And the Violence Against Women Act of 2005 builds upon the momentum started in 1994 with the original creation of the Violence Against Women Act. And that act created special avenues of immigration relief for certain domestic abuse survivors. 6 years later, in 2000, Congress created special visas for certain immigrant crime victims, and now in 2005, Congress has expanded protections even more to protect survivors of domestic abuse, sexual assault, elder abuse, or dating violence. And either now or later on in the show, I can talk more about what some of those provisions are.
Okay. So it sounds like, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that there is a way for women who are trying to come to the United States to escape this kind of violence. There is a way for them to get in. It's just that it's different. It's not making the kind of claim that falls under the kinds of persecution that the asylum law covers, but that there is a way to do it. It's just a different way.
Well, I should qualify that. There is a way for certain victims of domestic violence. For instance, if you're married to a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, are people, sometimes we refer to them as green card holders, and if you are married to one of them and you're abused, you can self-petition for legal status. But if you happen to be married to a person who is undocumented, meaning they lack lawful papers to remain in the United States, or you're married to somebody who is here on another type of work visa or student visa and you're abused by them, the Violence Against Women Act does not create a way for those immigrant victims of violence to seek legal status. So your statement earlier is there is a way for a certain group, but it's not a way for all victims of domestic abuse.
Okay, so there are still a lot of women for whose experience that there's just no, right now the law doesn't address it.
That is correct, unfortunately.
Okay. Maybe it would help. Maybe I'll turn back to Karen Misalu, because you've been actually involved in some of these cases, to give people something a little bit more concrete so that they can think about and understand what it is we're talking about. Can you give us a kind of a case study that would serve as an example?
Yes, and what I'll do is I'll pick a case study that actually of an individual who wouldn't be covered by the forms of relief that Joanne was referring to, just so that we really underscore that issue that you know there still is a need to get the asylum laws to accept this. So perhaps what I can use as an example is the case of Rody Alvarado. She is, her case will probably be very significant in the development of law on this issue. Rody Alvarado is a Guatemalan woman who was married to a former military person in her home country of Guatemala, and over 10 years was subjected to the most brutal and sadistic battering at the hands of her husband. And just to, you know, I don't want to be, you know, sensationalistic about this, but just so people understand what we're talking about in terms of the abuse, this is a man who would drag his wife around by her hair and break windows and mirrors with her head and throw a machete across the room at her, wake her up in the middle of the night with a knife to her throat and tell her that he could kill her and nobody would care. When she tried to escape from him within Guatemala, he would track her down. And on one occasion, when he found her, he just beat her unconscious in front of their two children. So she went to the police within Guatemala. She went to the courts within Guatemala trying to get protection. And this highlights the issue that we're talking about asylum only in situations where the countries will not protect the woman. And she sought protection from the police and the courts, and they said, you know, this is domestic violence. We really, go home. We don't get involved in this. And finally, after about 10 years of this treatment, where she felt that she would lose her life if she remained, and she'd been so badly battered and abused, she finally decided that she would, and she didn't really make a conscious decision. There were some fortuitous circumstances where some people offered to help her, and she ended up in the U.S. and ended up seeking asylum. And so this would be an example of the kind of harm that we're talking about. And her case has had a quite complicated procedural history. It's been pending back and forth for 10 years. She was battered for 10 years. She's been seeking asylum for 10 years in the U.S. And later, if you'd like me to go into some detail, David, about what's happened and what the current status is, I'd be glad to do that. But just to underscore how controversial the issue is, her plea for asylum has still not been decided. And I should say that all sides in the issue agree that all of the facts that I described are absolutely true. So there's no issue of the credibility or the truthfulness of this claim. It's just whether or not our asylum laws should extend protection.
Mm-hmm. And it's also my understanding that one of the problems people point to about the law is that there's a kind of a time limitation that you have to file the claim within a particular amount of time, or else it won't even be considered.
Yes, that's true. In 1996, Congress enacted a deadline on filing for asylum, and it's within a one year of arriving in the U.S. Now, fortunately, Rody Alvarado actually arrived in the U.S. and applied for asylum before this law went into effect, so she was not subject to it. But I can tell you from my experience on this issue that many asylum seekers, not just women, men, women, children, when they come to the U.S. and they're quite traumatized by what they suffered and they don't have a family network, they have no resources, it is very, very understandable that many of them would not file within the one-year deadline. And if they don't, then they are barred from asylum. There are some exceptions to that, but from our research on the issue, the one-year deadline is applied quite restrictively. And often, even if a woman arguably comes within those exceptions, the one-year deadline is still applied to the individual.
Perhaps I should just very quickly introduce again both of you to people who are listening, if someone has just tuned in the last little bit. Karen Misalo is resident scholar at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, where she directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She also teaches refugee law and international human rights. Joanne Lin is senior staff attorney at Legal Momentum. This is the nation's oldest women's legal rights organization. She's a national expert on immigration legal options for abused immigrants. Both of them will be here in Champaign-Urbana on the campus a little later this week on Wednesday for a conference discussing these issues, taking place at the Lucy Ellis Lounge in the Foreign Languages Building on Wednesday from 7 to 9 in the evening. And I am assuming that anyone here in and around Champaign-Urbana who is interested in attending could do that. Also, questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to perhaps turn to Joanne Lin and ask you to talk a little bit about the question, or is there a way in which currently our concerns about, or some people's concerns about, undocumented people coming to the United States gets tangled up with this particular issue of asylum for abused women?
Sure. I can address that in the context of immigration options for abused women without focusing solely on asylum, if that will fine. I'm sure many of you know about the immigration reform debate that is currently taking place on the Senate floor. There have also been immigration marches and rallies across the United States where hundreds of thousands of people have marched in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. Notably, in Chicago last month, there were upwards of 100,000 people who showed up and marched, exceeding all the organizers' expectations. And I should note that Senator Durbin from Illinois is one of our great champions in the Senate on immigrants' rights and women's rights. That being said, Congress is currently debating many different proposals that are looking at everything from strict border patrol, draconian immigration enforcement, to some positive provisions that are aimed at legalizing the 11 million undocumented people in the United States. These proposals are very controversial. They're very complex. And the House last December passed a very harsh proposal called House Resolution H.R. 4437. Two of the significant provisions in that proposal include the criminalization of all forms of unlawful presence, as well as the criminalization of anyone who aids an undocumented person. So what does this mean? It means that if a battered woman who is undocumented, if she calls the police for help because she's being beaten and she and her children, their lives are in jeopardy, she can now be arrested and imprisoned for doing nothing wrong other than lacking lawful papers. I should just clarify, this is under the proposed law. It's not the current law right now. Mm-hmm. So instead of recognizing that these domestic violence victims need help, H.R. 4437 turns these victims into criminals merely for lacking papers. And as we know, in homes across the United States, police intervention can mean the difference between life and death for battered women and children. And H.R. 4437 cuts these women off from the police, thereby jeopardizing these women's lives. In addition, H.R. 4437 would criminalize the domestic violence shelter worker in Champaign-Urbana. She could go to prison for doing nothing more than her job in providing refuge and shelter to undocumented victims of violence. And instead of thanking these domestic violence service providers and advocates, H.R. 4437 criminally punishes them for protecting these victims. And one of our major fears here at Legal Momentum is that if H.R. 4437 provisions are enacted, victim service programs across the United States will close their doors to all immigrant women and children for fear of being imprisoned. And I just want to be clear, these anti-immigrant proposals were passed in the House bill, H.R. 4437, and many of these proposals are also included in Senate Majority Leader's Frist bill, which is currently being debated on the Senate floor. The Senate is debating immigration this week and is expected to vote on an immigration bill by the end of this week. So really, now is the time for all those listeners who are engaged on this immigration debate and who are concerned about immigrant battered and women and children, now is the time to make your voices heard by calling your senators and urging them to support comprehensive immigration reform and to oppose these immigration enforcement-only provisions.
Let me also, I want to ask, maybe I'll ask Karen Misalo a similar but different kind of question, and I guess I'm also interested how this, for you, the because you're primarily concerned with or have been concerned with this asylum issue, how that gets tangled up with concerns about Homeland Security and whether, in fact, is this something, did September 11th, 2001 somehow change the way that people thought about this issue of women and asylum?
You know, I think September 11th actually, exacerbated the situation in terms of attitude towards immigrants and asylum seekers. But I think if you look at the U.S. historically, there have been cycles of how welcoming or not the U.S. has been towards migrants and asylum seekers. I think it's worse now, that's clear. There is more fear that people have. But I think that what is unfortunate is that people, perhaps there's some pandering to that fear, and instead of coming up with proposals that really are tailored to make the American people more safe, to really have sensible ways to address national security concerns, there's this sort of, draconian measures towards all individuals, treating them all as criminals. And as Joanne said, when she was describing criminalizing, making it into a felony for any individual to be here unlawfully, even if for a day. And that could be a person who's an asylum seeker. So it really is taking everybody and lumping them up under sort of the rubric of being terrorists and treating them all as criminals. So I think that's one piece of it, and I think it's unfortunate, and I think ultimately it doesn't make anyone safer. It just really is a simplistic solution to real problems that do exist. Secondly, though, one thing I'd like to say is that what has often come up with the women's claims as opposition to them, even before September 11th, was this fear of the floodgates, that somehow if you accept things like domestic violence or female genital cutting or honor killing as a basis for asylum, that the U.S. will be inundated with women seeking asylum. And I know this because I was a lead attorney in a case which was decided in 1996, the case of Fozia Kasinga, which did establish that women fleeing the very damaging practice of female genital cutting could qualify for asylum. That was 1996, and the predictions were all, before the case was granted, the predictions on those opposing it was that if she were given asylum, the U.S. would absolutely be flooded with the millions of women around the world who face this practice. The Immigration Service itself kept statistics after she was granted asylum, and they reported that there was absolutely no explosion of claims from women fleeing female genital cutting. And I should note that Canada has accepted all of these types of gender claims since 1993, and they've kept statistics, and they also have not experienced any claims. The gender claims have been just a minuscule proportion of their overall claims for asylum. So I would just say to people that are fearful at this point that the fear of the floodgates is really not a realistic fear. I respect and understand the way in which people are concerned about various range of immigration issues, but it simply is not a realistic concern that the U.S. will be flooded should it accept this kind of claim.
Hmm. Well, I imagine people will, or at least some people will recall the case that you mentioned about the woman who was trying to come to the United States, or had come to the United States trying to escape with this procedure that it's sometimes, I think, euphemistically almost referred to as female circumcision. Her request was successful, and I'm not arguing that it shouldn't have been, but I wonder how it is one made the argument that she should be granted asylum given the way that the law is written, as you described it at the beginning, the idea being that the assumption is that it's a person who is facing persecution or has the well-founded fear of persecution because of their race, their religion, their nationality, their social group, and that the idea is that it's something that comes from the government, not from, for example, a member of their family. I mean, how did she qualify, given that that's the way the asylum law is written?
Yes, thank you for asking that question. You know, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, well, let me back up and say that the refugee definition comes from international treaty that many, many countries around the world, including the U.S., has ratified. And that treaty, there's guidance given about what that treaty means in terms of defining who's a refugee. Guidance is given by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And in the 1980s, the UNHCR began to see that the refugee definition was being interpreted in a very male-centric way, and that really there was nothing about the words in the definition that limited it in that way that portrayed the kind of assumptions that I identified earlier. And UNHCR began to give some guidance, and what it said, for instance, was in looking at whether something is persecution, you look at human rights norms, and if something is a violation of human rights norms, it should be recognized as persecution. So if you look at female genital cutting, it is a violation in many treaties and declarations. It is a human rights violation, so it can be recognized as persecution. Also, the UNHCR and other governments have U.S. itself has long recognized that the persecution doesn't have to be by the government. It can be by a non-governmental actor where the government cannot or will not protect the individual. So in a country where female genital cutting is inflicted on women and the government, you know, has not criminalized it, or even if it's criminalized it, just turns a blind eye, that could qualify as persecution, whether it's the government or a non-state actor. And then finally, and most importantly, even though gender isn't one of the five grounds, what UNHCR has recommended, and which a great number of countries have now accepted, is that that particular ground that's called membership in a particular social group can include gender, that it is very appropriate to say that you define a social group by reference to gender. So in the Kasinga case, the woman fleeing female genital cutting, it was women of a certain ethnic group within which female genital cutting was practiced. That was a particular social group. So there really is a way without doing, you know, really without going outside the refugee definition, but just, you know, not interpreting it in a male-centric way, which when you think about it, there is no way. It should be no reason it should be interpreted in a male-centric way, and there is a way that it can be applied to women's claims.
Hmm. I don't know, Joanne, anything that you might want to weigh in on here that we've been talking about here at the last little bit?
Well, going back to a point that Karen was discussing a few minutes ago about kind of the unfortunate wide sweep of the current immigration proposals that unfortunately sweep in asylum seekers, victims of domestic violence. It's just cast way too broadly. It really is unfortunate because there's never been, for instance, any link between an asylum seeker and any type of national security threat to the United States. And yet Congress, you know, will proceed with these bills that are not really grounded in any empirical cases. And I think that's something that the public just really needs to be aware of. I also wanted to go back to what I mentioned at the top of the show, the Violence Against Women Act of 2000, which was signed into law by President Bush at the beginning of this year, because there are several highlights that are very important for immigrant victims, and I think many people don't know about them. First, victims of elder abuse who are abused by their adult U.S. citizen son or daughter can now self-petition for permanent residency. Previously, the immigration laws had created a way for abused spouses and abused children to self-petition for permanent residency, and now under the 2005 law, this relief has been extended to abused parents. Secondly, children who were abused by their parents or who are incest victims, they can now self-petition for legal status up to age 25. Prior to the Violence Against Women Act of 2005, child abuse victims had to self-petition before they turned 21. Now they have an additional 4 years to seek permanent residency. And this can make a huge difference for a child abuse or incest victim. Thirdly, the Violence Against Women Act of 2005 grants employment authorization, a work permit, to abused spouses of certain immigrant workers. And these immigrant workers are people who are working in specialty occupations as diplomats for international organizations or as Australian investors. So prior to the 2005 law, these abused spouses were locked into violent marriages because they could not work lawfully and they did not qualify for public benefits. The 2005 law gives these abused spouses a work permit so they can now establish an independent stream of income and not be solely dependent on their violent spouse. And this provision is going to have a tremendous benefit, in particular in the South Asian community, as there are many South Asian women married to men working in the high-tech industry. Finally, the Violence Against Women Act of 2005 ensures that all legal services corporation-funded programs can represent any survivor of domestic abuse, sexual assault, dating violence, regardless of the survivor's immigration status, marital status, or sexual orientation. Each county has a legal services corporation-funded program which provides free legal services to indigent people. And prior to the 2005 law, many legal services corporation-funded programs were turning away victims of violence because they were undocumented or because they were not married to the batterer or because they were involved in a gay or lesbian relationship. The new law removes all of these restrictions and opens the door for all indigent victims of violence to seek free legal services. And those are just some of the highlights of the Violence Against Women Act of 2005. For people who want a detailed summary of the immigration provisions, they should visit Legal Momentum's website, which has a detailed summary. And our website is www.legalmomentum.org. Again, that's www.legalmomentum.org.
You know, given the kind of rhetoric that sometimes is flying around, or at least it flies around today, as far as in undocumented people are concerned, it surprises me almost in a way that this law got passed at all.
You're not alone in that surprise, David. And actually, the law was passed by unanimous consent, which means unanimous consent by every member in the House and Senate. And I do credit Congress with understanding the special concerns and some of the barriers that immigrant victims of abuse face. But at the same time, just 3 months later, the same Congress is looking at passing provisions in these immigration enforcement proposals that would undo over a decade of progress made in the Violence Against Women Act. One of the key tenets behind the Violence Against Women Act is to remove barriers that prevent immigrant victims from accessing police, the criminal justice system, social services, counseling, and other support systems for immigrant victims. However, H.R. 4437 and Senator Frist's proposal would basically turn this on its head by turning these victims into criminals. Because if an undocumented woman is worried that calling the police is going to result in her arrest and imprisonment, she is never going to call the police. And ultimately, that is going to compromise the U.S. criminal justice system's ability to arrest and prosecute batterers, rapists, stalkers. So I think you're right, David, that it seems a little bit surprising, but I think at the same time, it also illustrates some of the unintended consequences that proposed legislation can bring.
We have a caller here, and we get right to them. I just very quickly want to introduce again the guests for anyone who has tuned in the last 5-10 minutes. The last person you heard speak is Joanne Lynn. She's senior staff attorney at Legal Momentum. It's the nation's oldest women's legal rights organization. She is national expert on immigration legal options for abused immigrants. And before joining Legal Momentum, she practiced immigration law in San Francisco for 5 years. Also joining us by telephone, Karen Musalo. She is resident scholar at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, where she directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She also teaches refugee law and international human rights. She has also litigated a number of significant asylum decisions. The two of them will be here to take part in a program, Seeking Asylum, Refugee Women, Family, Violence, and Law, this week on the U of I campus on Wednesday evening, sponsored by Women and Gender in Global Perspectives and also the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. We do have a caller here, someone in Aurora, who's been patient with us, and we'll go right there on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
I just want to thank you for doing the work you are doing. It's a work that is so absolutely necessary. And I just am so thankful that this is being done. The reason I became involved with it myself was that my daughter was in an abusive marriage, and just with her being in this country, in a neighboring state, it was so difficult. It took us 8 years to get her out of the abusive marriage. So I just want to thank you for the women of the world to do this work for us and for the people that it's so necessary to have a life, a free life. Thank you so much.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for the call. I don't know if either of you want to
This is Joanne Lynn. I thank the caller for your statements, and really our thanks go back to you. I think you nicely pointed out that all victims of domestic abuse face enormous barriers in terms of leaving a violent home. It is not uncommon for a battered woman to try to leave 6, 7, 8, 10 times before she's eventually able to. And it's critical to have family support and access to legal services, social services, the criminal justice system. I would just mention, for instance, I don't know the caller's immigration status, but under assuming, let's say, the caller were undocumented or if the caller's daughter were undocumented, if these immigration enforcement proposals were actually implemented, the caller could actually, unfortunately, be arrested and go to jail for protecting her daughter, helping her move out of the violent home, helping her relocate, helping her get counseling and other services. And I think that's really important for people to understand that that is the practical effect of this law that's supposedly aimed at detecting national security threats to the United States.
Well, let's stop.
And this is Karen. I just want to also thank the caller and echo everything that Joanne said. I really agree with that heartily.
All right. Well, let us take another caller. This is someone in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Yes. Hi. I was wondering. I realize this problem is very widespread, unfortunately, but instead of just dealing with people like giving asylum and immigration issues, does the U.S. government have any kind of policies at all where it imposes sanctions or puts pressure on any governments of other countries where this type of abuse is most pronounced or most widespread? And I'll hang up now. Thanks.
Okay.
Yes, this is Karen. I'd like to answer that question because I really thank you for that call because we think that, although it's very important to protect the women who flee and to give them asylum, that really what makes sense as a global approach to this is to look at the root causes. What are the situations that exist in these countries that allow women to be to suffer these human rights violations, and can the U.S. address that in its foreign policy so that we get at the root causes? And one thing, for instance, let me give you a very short example. The lead case around domestic violence as a basis for asylum is the case of the Guatemalan woman Rody Alvarado. And if you look at Guatemala and the issue of violation of women's rights there, it's an incredible example. Guatemala has been experiencing what we call femicides, where in the last 4 years there have been over 2,500 women killed in the most misogynistic and sadistic way. People know about the killings of women in Mexico and Ciudad Juarez, and just for purposes of comparison, there have been about 400 to 500 women killed in Ciudad Juarez in the last 13 years. There's been 2,500 in Guatemala just in the last 4 years. And at the same time, the Guatemalan government has had a total failure to investigate or prosecute these killings. And at the same time that it's failed to do that, the U.S. has huge investments in improving the administration of justice and the functioning of the police force in Guatemala. Since 1992, there's been over, I believe, $50 million invested in their system. So what we're saying is, on the one hand, give political asylum to Rody Alvarado, but on the other hand, ask the Guatemalan government to be accountable, to show results in their judicial system and their police system to protect the rights of women. And if they can't do that, to incrementally impose some kinds of pressures on the government, not necessarily sanctions to begin with, but some kinds of ways to get governments to protect the rights of women. Hmm.
Just you talked a little bit about Rody Alvarado a little bit earlier about the fact that here this is the case of a woman, a Guatemalan woman, who experienced a number of years of domestic violence by her husband, tried to get help from the police and the courts in Guatemala, could not, and so she left. She left Guatemala, came to the United States, hoping to escape that abuse, and that her case is now up in the air, has sort of been up in the air for some time now. What is her status right now, and what do you think is likely to happen?
Well, very quickly, to give you an idea of how controversial and how back and forth the issue is, she was originally granted asylum by an immigration judge in San Francisco back in 1996, and the Immigration Service appealed, and it went up to something called the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is kind of like the Supreme Court of immigration decisions, and that Board of Immigration Appeals took the asylum away. That was in 1999. And a lot of people were very upset, a lot of different constituencies from women's rights to human rights, and they got Janet Reno, who was then Attorney General, to pay attention to the case. And so Janet Reno intervened, and her Justice Department issued proposed regulations, and she said this case should be decided once these regulations come out as final. This was now more than 5 years ago, and the regulations have still not come out, and what I've been told by friends inside the government is that they can't agree on what form the regulations should take because there is so much controversy and disagreement within the administration as to whether or not women in these circumstances should be granted asylum. So Rhodey has been waiting now for a decision, and while she's waiting, she's separated from the two children that she left behind when she fled 10 years ago. And so it's an example of how delay, you know, some people said, well, she waits, but she's here and she's safe while she's waiting. But we also have to see how with asylum seekers, they're separated from ones they love, which is a very, very difficult situation to be in.
Are there other women that are similarly here and have applied and are just waiting?
There are. There's been sort of a variety of things that have happened in these cases. In the absence of some clear guidance from the administration, from the executive branch on this issue, judges have been deciding the issue across the country, and they have gone either way. So it's been very arbitrary. So on any particular case with similar facts, you could have one case being granted in one part of the country and case with similar facts being denied in another part of the country, and then a big pool of cases just being sat on with the judges saying, well, we're waiting for these regulations to come out. And it's unfortunate because, frankly, at this point, I think this shouldn't be such a hard decision to make. And I just might note that you know, many other countries have decided this issue in a favorable way. I mentioned Canada earlier, but the United Kingdom has taken the right approach on this. New Zealand, Australia, Spain, South Africa, Ireland. So many of the countries that are industrialized or Western countries that receive refugees have said, yes, women who flee because of violations of their fundamental human rights in situations such as domestic violence, they do meet the refugee definition. But for some reason, the U.S. just has not been able to reach some consensus on that issue and decide it definitively one way or the other.
And in these other countries where you think that where at least you would feel that was a more appropriate way of dealing with the issue and in giving them refugee status under those asylum provisions, have those countries seen some kind of big jump? And when you get to the point where it changed, was there some sort of big jump there in the numbers of women who were seeking asylum and based on those grounds?
Well, what I can say is the country that's kept the most kind of fastidious records on this or meticulous records has been Canada. But what I could say for most of the other countries across the European Union is that the number of asylum seekers in general has plummeted in most of the countries in the EU. And people think, frankly, that's because countries have made it much more difficult to access their territory. They've made it difficult for asylum seekers to enter. And so the benefit, in a way, is balanced against the benefit of recognizing this. But at the same time, countries have put up so many roadblocks for asylum seekers to enter. So I guess the answer would be is there hasn't been an explosion. There's been an overall drop in claims in many of the countries that I mentioned.
Hmm. I think our earlier caller from Aurora wanted to perhaps make an additional comment or add another thought. So she's back with us. Let's talk with her again. Hello.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about this as an international case and cases, and I just wanted to say that my daughter recently got sole guardianship of a 12-year-old Hispanic child. Lovely girl. And when she became 14, she said to my daughter, when am I going to take contraceptive pills? So my daughter said, why? She said, well, somebody might rape me. She said, why? She says, because it happens. Because it's something that's taken for granted. So my daughter said, no, it will not happen. Do not worry about it. You will not take contraceptive pills. So this is in my own family, in a country or in a town that you would never expect anything like that, but it is happening. Does the person have anything to say about this?
Well, again, I don't know. Ms. Lynn, Ms. Misala, you can comment on it any way you like.
Well, I mean, this is Joanne Lynn talking. Of course, I mean, I'm so sorry to hear that, and I think that what that points out is that domestic abuse is very prevalent, and it's unfortunately common in all communities. both within the United States and outside of the United States. And it's an issue that you know, requires constant education and people becoming more sensitized to the concerns. And it sounds like the caller is really facing that, has faced that very directly in her family. And I just think it's wonderful that you're able to share some of your observations and your learning with other people, and hopefully that'll make a difference with
yes,
the other
and
people.
And that's what I
here.
Had hoped to do. And I'm just so relieved that this child is with us, that we can give her the life that she should have, because she's a lovely child. But the scars of life have hit her already, and we will just have to hope that in the ensuing years she will be able to work through and have a better life. Thank you.
You know, David, the caller's comment reminded me that, you know, Karen and I have been talking about primarily battered women, but both asylum and the immigration options against, under the Violence Against Women Act also provide relief for child abuse victims. So, you know, for instance, a child who's been abused by a U.S. citizen step-parent may be able to seek legal status. And as you can imagine, very few children are aware of any of their legal rights, and compound that with them being an immigrant and English maybe not their first language and being isolated in an abusive home, it's very unlikely that they'll know that there might be a way for them to seek legal status without having to remain in a violent home.
Mm-hmm.
So I thank you for the caller's comment.
Sure. Well, given the fact that the people that we're talking about do have all those conditions do apply, we may have people who don't speak English or maybe don't speak English well. They're maybe in a way because of circumstance, because of their husbands, who knows, confined to their homes, or it's difficult for them to get out. How well are those people who are interested in providing assistance and help to women who are victims of domestic violence, how well are they able to address the need of this group of people, again, given that all those particular kind of circumstances apply? I mean, set aside the concern about the immigration issues, is this an underserved group?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think everyone will agree that family violence has probably been with us from the beginning of human civilization. Even coining the term or understanding it as a problem that's not specific to a given family or a given marriage, that's relatively recent. It's really all within our lifetime. So the work that's before us in terms of protecting women and children, whether they're U.S. citizens, permanent residents, or other immigrants, that really is work for all of us to work through our churches, our neighborhood organizations, our communities, our schools. And it involves the work of both professional, you know, domestic violence service providers, advocates, the criminal justice system, as well as people like the caller who are directly affected by it, or people who get involved in these issues because a friend comes to them or a colleague or a neighbor.
Mm-hmm. We have one more call I want to make sure we get to before we find ourselves out of time. This is someone listening in Champaign. We'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Is this me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. As a feminist, I'm strongly committed to all of the issues that you've talked about, but I'm also concerned that gender not be used as a stand-in term for women. So I was wondering how these issues affect gay men, transgendered people, you know, et cetera.
And I could just say a few words about this in the asylum context, and then Joanne can talk about the other immigration remedies. There is an acceptance within U.S. law that individuals who are persecuted because of their sexual orientation can be granted asylum protection, and that is a great victory. And that actually was resolved prior to this controversy, or how can I say this? That issue is resolved, whereas the issue of women asylum seekers is not. Not to say that individuals who are gay or lesbian, transgender, don't have difficulties in their cases, but it is accepted in the law that persecution for sexual orientation can be a basis for asylum protection.
Yes, and I think the caller points out a very important point. The Violence Against Women Act in some ways is a misnomer, because all the immigration options are provided to victims of violence regardless of gender. And so there certainly are male victims of family violence who have attained legal status. The reason the term is used, the Violence Against Women Act, is because studies indicate that the disproportionate number of victims or survivors are women. As I mentioned earlier on the call, we have had some gains in providing immigration protection for gay and lesbian victims, although we still have a long way to go. So, for instance, in 2000, Congress created a special visa called the U visa, and that's a visa for certain immigrant crime victims who are willing to cooperate with law enforcement in an investigation or prosecution of a crime. The U visa was created in part because of the recognition that the prior Violence Against Women Act was really only designed for people who are either married to abusers or who are the children of abusers. The U visa is designed to protect larger groups of people, including, let's say, victims of dating violence who are in gay-lesbian relationships. As I also mentioned earlier in the call, one of the major gains we got in the Violence Against Women Act of 2005 is that now any legal services corporation-funded program can represent any victim of violence, including gay and lesbian victims. It doesn't mandate that these programs do so, but in the past, if you were an indigent victim and you went into your legal services office or you called up their intake line, they would ask you a series of questions. And if they determined that you were not married to the person who was harming you, they legally had to turn you away. Now those victims can go to those programs to obtain the legal protections they need for their own safety.
We are going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Joanne Lynn. She's a senior staff attorney at Legal Momentum. Ms. Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
And Karen Misalo, resident scholar at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, where she directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. And Karen Misalo, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being on the program.
And I want to say again that the two of them will be here to take part in a program, Seeking Asylum, Refugee Women, Family Violence, and Law, sponsored by Women and Gender in Global Perspectives and also the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. If you'd like to find out more about this, I'd suggest you go to the website of the Women and Gender in Global Perspectives program. That's a unit of international programs and studies here at the University of Illinois. Before we go, we want you to know programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming